is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and I'm continuing to enjoy the many benefits of being live from WNYC Studios in New York City this week.
This is a Manhattan-bound Q local train. The next stop is Parkside Avenue.
Making radio this way is truly different because I'm sharing space with our morning team. Our director, Jay, gives visual cues to wrap a question or stretch a segment.
All right, watch your clock here. About 30 seconds left. Just getting to that last question there.
Our sound designer, Vince, can sense change and conversational energy and create new audio tracks to support the story. Our line producer, Jackie, catches my enthusiasm with a response and crafts a perfect edit to highlight it.
She was so good. I don't want to edit any of that.
Now, making radio this way is not only a song, it's a dance. At our best, communicating with one another is always multilingual. You don't have to understand all the vocabulary of American Sign Language to glean the emphasis, emotion, and structure of a gifted ASL interpreter.
He said, son un poeta.
You don't have to speak Italian to be moved by an operatic aria. And we are a multilingual nation. About 1 in 5 Americans speaks more than one language in their home. But search the world of podcasts, and it's tough to find audio storytelling that moves beyond an English-only framework. Now, we do have a great one here at WNYC Studios, La Brega, and you should check it out. But it's still rare, which is at least part of why Danielle Alarcón has been recognized this year as a MacArthur Genius Fellow. Alarcón is the executive producer and host of NPR's Spanish language podcast, Radio Ambulante. He's a contributing writer at The New Yorker and a novelist. He also teaches at the Columbia Journalism School. Alarcón's work dives deep into the social and cultural ties that connect Spanish-speaking populations across the United States and Central and South America. His podcast, Radio Ambulante, which he started in 2012, features a mix of investigative journalism and interviews and covers a wide range of topics, from a refugee crisis in Venezuela to killer bees in Brazil, to the ripple effects of Pablo Escobar's purchase of 4 hippos in Colombia.
Un hipopótamo. Paseando como si nada por las calles de Doradal, un pueblo colombiano que queda cerca del río Magdalena. Es de noche y camina lento, no se ven los niños que gritan, solo se ve el animal enorme.
I spoke with Alarcón about his work and why it's important to have his podcast be in Spanish.
There was nothing like what I was imagining and what my wife and I were thinking of producing. I think we have to go back to the origin story briefly. I was asked to do a radio documentary for the BBC about these kind of phantom towns in Peru that where the people move, everyone moves to the city. And that experience of reporting it and then having all the voices in Spanish basically cut out was so disappointing to me. And that really answers your question, Melissa, because it was a sense of, wow, there's these very important stories to be told, and yet the protagonists of these stories aren't able to tell them the way they would want to tell them. And I just felt like something was missing. So Carolina and I started thinking about what that show would sound like, and we just didn't know any better than to say, okay, well, we might as well make it ourselves.
I frequently teach Gloria Enzandula's La Frontera, Borderlands, and fairly frequently have students who say, why doesn't she just translate the Spanish? Why do we have to read these parts that we don't understand?
Yeah, and I should be clear, I think translation is important. Translation is wonderful. I've translated books before and poetry, and I've read tons of stuff in translation. But I do think reading a transcript of something that was said in a different language doesn't quite convey the humor, the emotion, the placement of silences, all those magical things that radio does that if you have a voiceover, you're probably going to miss. And also there's another thing too, translation, especially with all the diversity of accents and types of Spanish that are spoken in Latin America and in the US, translation into English sort of flattens that. And one of the things that's beautiful about Rambulante, when we started Rambulante, thinking about this project, we were like, wow, it'd be so great to have a story from El Salvador, and then a story from Mexico, and a story from Chile, and a story from Colombia and Cuba. And it's all these different types of Spanish. It's not, there is not one monolithic Spanish. And have them all together and just celebrate all those accents and all those unique vocabularies that each country will have. I thought that was just something that would make the show itself special, the fact that it was regional.
Has access to Spanish language storytelling improved? Has it gotten better in recent years? Or what are some of the key gaps that still exist in our media landscape?
Well, there has been an explosion of new shows coming out of Latin America, and I think that's wonderful and something to be celebrated. I mean, for Rambulante, I can tell you what our challenges are in terms of there's more places we want to cover. There's places where it's harder to find the right collaborators to work with. And you can just sort of look through our catalog and see we've done very little reporting from certain countries and a lot more reporting from others, you know, and that's just one of the complications of our work, but we're trying to fix that. I think the other thing is there sometimes isn't, I think a recognition of the value of Spanish language journalism. And I don't mean it necessarily at the national level, but I mean like there are really important local Spanish language reporting projects that are serving very specific communities. They don't get any awards, they don't get any attention, but they're really doing that service journalism that is vital. It would be great to see some of that get the attention that it deserves.
So I'm wondering, because you are also a writer, the ways that telling story through audio has potentially impacted how you write or how you think about the creation of narrative in the written form.
When I wrote fiction, I always read my work aloud, and I was always really into the way it felt in my ears. You know, that was very important to me. You know, and I spent more than a few nights, you know, in my 20s at the New York Poets Cafe listening to spoken word artists. And I spent countless hours listening to, you know, singers and poets and rappers and the musicality of all kinds of speech, and just really was something that I cared about deeply. I also think that, you know, storytelling or narrative journalism and podcasts it shares a lot with literature. You know, when you're reading a book, it's like the author's whispering in your ear, and it's very similar to the experience of having your earbuds on and the intimate relationship you might have with a storyteller in audio. To me, they felt like complementary art forms or complementary, you know, narrative strategies. So this was something that in some ways it felt like not an illogical leap at all, but something that sort of made perfect sense to me. When we started Rambulante in my early 30s, I was in my early 30s, and I'd been, you know, writing, I'd written books and, you know, I'd written stories and long pieces of nonfiction and a couple of novels. And I was sort of like, you know, I sort of knew my way around. I sort of knew what I was doing. And it was so liberating to not know what I was doing. It was such a wonderful experience. And I really recommend it to anybody to just step into the unknown and try something new. You don't even know what rules you're breaking because you don't know the rules. And it's super liberating and it's scary. And it helped me with my writing tremendously because it sort of, you know, you're back at the point of where you're crawling and then walking and then, you know, ideally at some point running, but you know, just to go back and hit that learning curve again, it just reminds you that, oh, there's so much more I can do and learn.
I hear you speak that like, not only like a true teacher, but as a true student, someone who takes genuine pleasure, excitement, thrill from the unknown, from not even mastery, but just the attempts, right? The getting there, the finding something new. So what are some of the other corners that you haven't explored? What are some of the trails that you imagine, trailheads that might be in front of you, that you'd like to start walking down as you're thinking about the ways to do storytelling and journalism in Spanish-speaking context?
For not this season, but the previous season of Rambulante, I did a stop-motion animation for the trailer of Rambulante. But yeah, I spent a week sort of cutting up old magazines and making a 2-minute film, video, trailer, whatever. And I was immersed in it and spent hours a day doing it. And I remember thinking to myself, like, God, I could really get into this. You know, it was like, this would be really fun, like, to do forever. I mean, I think that there's always more that I would like to do. And I guess the most amazing and truly humbling thing about the MacArthur is someone decided that it was worth giving me the time and the opportunity to just see what happens, to just try. So I intend to be brave and try new things and maybe fail, maybe not. And in the spirit of learning that you mentioned, I think that's the whole point.
I gotta say, one of the things I've seen fall out of the educational experience for so many college students in particular, but also prior to college, is the willingness to explore languages that are not their first language to speak, because they're often not going to get an A. I mean, there's a group of students who will, but there's other students who think, man, I'd like to understand Greek, or I'd like to try to get better at Spanish, but I'm terrified because I've got this GPA to hold on to. And walking into the unknown space of new language may mean that I do not succeed. And I'm wondering if you've thought at all about how we can, again, make some of that space for creativity, for exploration, but particularly for the exploration in language, so that we maybe can speak to each other in more than one language.
Yeah, I love that question, but I would expand the definition of language to say, you know, artistic language, musical language, scientific language, historical language. I mean, I think that there's sometimes in education too much emphasis on mastery and not enough on curiosity and on the real rewards of just trying something and maybe failing, but, you know, becoming conversant in a new way of speaking and approaching the world. You know, this is not just a problem of education. It's, you know, it's also a problem in families. It's also, you know, me trying to get my kids to speak Spanish is also a challenge, you know? I think we can only sort of push the idea that real connection requires real intention. You know, when you make that effort to try to learn a new language, you're going to get it back in so many ways that you can't even expect, you know. And I've had, I mean, my French is frankly atrocious, but I've had really, really great conversations in my busted French with people that otherwise they would have been having to do all the work of translating into a language that I speak. And just by being able to, you know, stammer out a few phrases and understand a little bit of what they were saying, I feel like I was able to demonstrate that I too was making an effort, and real communication requires real effort on two sides.
Danielle Alarcón is the executive producer and host of NPR's Radio Ambulante podcast and a contributing writer at The New Yorker and a novelist. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa. It's been a pleasure.
Now, we have been discussing language and what it means and how it shapes the way we tell stories. The words we use to name ourselves are foundational to our language and foundational for shaping our identities and communicating who we are to the world. Afro-Latinidad, Latino, Latinx, Hispanic, all are just some part of the language used to identify people whose ethnic and familial heritage originates in a large portion of the world, including Spain, Mexico, Central America, South America, and the Caribbean. But what do these terms mean for those who use them? Joining me now is Michelle Reed Vasquez, an associate professor in the Department of Africana Studies at the University of Pittsburgh, where her specializations are in the African diaspora in the Caribbean and the Atlantic world, and Afro-Latinx history in the U.S. She's also the director of the Afro-Latinidad Studies Initiative. Michelle, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And also joining us is Ed Morales, journalist and author of Latinx, the New Force in American Politics and Culture. He's also a lecturer at the Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race at Columbia University. Ed, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
Okay, Ed, I'm going to start with you here in a conversation that actually got really intense yesterday among The Takeaway team and staff. What is up with the word Latinx and where did it come from?
Well, Latinx, in its popular use, really dates back to the middle of last decade. But there's evidence of X being used in identifying Latino identity as far back as the 70s, when there was an article published in Chicano Riqueño Journal that alluded to the use of X in Mexican identity. Also, there was use of X in among Chicana feminists in the 90s. But really, my students really started talking about it around 2014. And after years of students and the Pew Hispanic Resource Center saying that young people no longer wanted to identify with the broad label, some students started coming to me with this Latinx, which they said included LGBTQ people. I found it interesting because it alluded to the spectrum of identities among non-binary people that non-binary people have, and the ones that Latinos have in their own view of their racial identity.
Michelle, what's your first reaction to the word Latinx and kind of your take on it?
Sure. So I will have to admit I had to sit with it a minute because I teach Latino and I speak Spanish and so all of that. But as I read, as I said, let me just do a deep dive into the scholarship and how it's being presented. So of course, I ran into the piece about the gender neutral alternative to Latino and Latina to address non-binary individuals. But also, I kept thinking about the X in terms of African American history as well. And so a lot of the things lined up and I said, yeah, the X also refers to resistance to invisibility, resistance to exclusion. I said, okay, I can get with that. Let's bring on the X. Let's bring on the X.
So why not bring on the X rather than the X? I'll run through some of what happened, which undoubtedly has happened in your classrooms, but kind of happened in our, pitch space, which was on the one hand, some language about, hey, to understand Latino or Latina as gendered in the way we think of male and female is just not to understand the language, right? When something has the O or the A, that doesn't necessarily mean it is gendered male and female. It's just the form of the nouns in a way that just isn't really how English words work. And so therefore there is no need for the X. And then the other sort of conversation was, well, no, the X is fine, but we shouldn't use it as an X. We should in fact continue to make the word sound Spanish. And X is not part of sort of that linguistic discourse.
Use of the X not being something that's native to Spanish is, I think, part of the point of using X is to define a different sensibility or awareness that Latin American descended people have living in the United States. The use of Spanglish is something that marks the community. And actually in Latin America, there's a lot of dropping of English in sentences. So the strict adherence to language is sort of part of the normativity that language structures impose on people, and using the X is a kind of translanguaging act that is subversive to that.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that X does speak to this, the location in the U.S. It does speak to resistance to these kind of traditional forms with the endings of the O and the A, and also just of identities. So I think it's a useful appropriation of this X to mean all these different things that are resistant to kind of traditional understandings, but also to create space for these different identities that have not necessarily fit in more traditional arenas.
So I love both of these. I'm going to push one more on this, and then we'll move to some other pieces as well. Ed, I'm wondering, when I'm of a particular generation, and so I think about that X in part also as standing in for Malcolm X, right? And the ways in which sort of the X baseball cap that, was part of, a kind of 90s youth street fashion that also reflected an understanding of resistance to, to the American state and to the racism of the American state. And I'm wondering if that X gets deployed here in a similar way.
Well, certainly I would like it to be, you know, I've written pieces in which I've alluded to Malcolm X using that to symbolize the erasure of his ancestors and African culture from notions of what mainstream American culture are, you know. But, you know, there's a problem in the Latino community where doesn't want to recognize enough Africanness, and there's huge movements for advocacy of Afro-Latinidad. You know, I think that it's very fitting to allude to Malcolm X and his use of the letter X.
Let's dig into that other way of thinking about X as also almost like a map symbol, right? It's a reflection of intersectionality. So, Michelle, Afro-Latinidad, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So what does that mean? And how, sort of play for us out what that intersection of Blackness and Latin identity, how that plays out.
Let me start with the kind of a simple overview that, you know, there's certainly slavery throughout the Americas. 95% of enslaved Africans were brought to the Caribbean and Latin America, 5% to the U.S. So that's why there are so many people of African descent in Latin America and the Caribbean. And so when I talk about and teach about Afro-Latinidad, it refers to these multi-layered cultural identities that are shared and as well as unique. People of African descent with heritage in Spanish and Portuguese speaking countries who reside all over the world. So you can have Afro-Latinidad that connects to Portuguese speaking Africa, to Latin America and to the US diaspora communities. But it's really about celebrating, embracing, understanding the history of those people of African descent and acknowledging kind of the issues and processes that they continue to have to encounter. And particularly, I look at this hemisphere.
And what do you find in this hemisphere? How does that particular intersection give rise to particular cultural and historic formations, Michelle?
Sure. I mean, we see everything from cultural practices, so Santeria through Cuba and Candomblé coming out of Brazil, lots of African linguistic retentions throughout the hemisphere, processes like contemporary migration, issues of policing, civil rights more broadly, gender violence. There are a whole host of kind of transnational issues that connect people of African descent, particularly those who connect to Afro-Latin America and have communities in the U.S. and then connecting to more communities of African descent. Because remember, we have African immigrants and Afro-Caribbean immigrants and African-American populations throughout the community. So they really, those who are in the U.S. really add to this, to the nuances of what Blackness means in the U.S. in this U.S. context.
Part of what happens when we start to understand this intersection with Blackness is that right along with it comes forms of domination and racism.
Yeah, absolutely. The racism in Latin America in general has been disguised by the creation of ideologies that are known as mestizaje ideologies, which, you know, try to make sense of the mixed race hierarchy that Spanish colonialism imposed and try to make it turn into a positive for Latin American identity. But what that did in many countries was eliminating people from counting themselves in the census and bringing claims to the courts. You know, there's not enough precedent for discrimination against people in Latin America, Black people in Latin America. And so that's one of the ways of denying it, because there hasn't been many court cases that are brought. So this is something that's Latinx community is trying to work through more closely at this moment, because there are so many young scholars and leaders who are advocating for recognition of Afro-Latinidad. And, you know, Afro-Latinidad also alludes to the alliances and experiences that Latinx people have shared with African Americans, you know, going all the way back to the beginning of the 20th century, and most clearly manifested in things like the creation of hip hop and, you know, how New Yorican Poets Cafe, for instance, was closely associated with freestyle rappers in the 90s.
You can't just stop on freestyle rappers in the 90s and then stop. You got to give us the rest of that.
Know,
you
got to
give us Ramon. Come on now.
I felt like I was talking too much.
No, not at all. I was like, let's do this.
There's so much crossover between Latinx community and African-American community. In fact, you know, many Black Latinos found their way to both their African and Hispanic identities or Latino identities by being in the United States and sort of looking around them and seeing how they fit into the spectrum.
Michelle, I'm interested in this idea that at intersection, right, there is there are questions of conflict and of domination, but I think also about how in the U.S. Whiteness is itself a sort of an identity to be achieved, right? So and whiteness carries with it, of course, as we know, all the wages and the goodies and the privileges associated with it. And so for communities, there may be, like, to the extent that there is a capacity to achieve whiteness, and not everyone is allowed to, and I'm using that language purposely, right, to achieve whiteness, I'm wondering if there is also tension about the notion that the Afro-Latinidad will keep Latinx communities sort of tied to Blackness and to all of the disprivileges of Blackness, rather than allowing sort of an achievement of Latin American identity, of Hispanic identity, of Chicano identity to constitute a form of whiteness?
That's a really great question. I think in some way, I think for some people, definitely, because again, as Ed pointed out, it's Blackness is not so much recognized or valued in Latin America. And so when those cultural pieces show up in the U.S., and I see it in my classroom, I have students, Dominican students, for example, who know that they are of African descent. Like they, like, I cannot deny it, but I talk to my parents and they refuse to use the word. They refuse to say that they're Black. And so so they're often kind of concerned about, well, where does this leave me? What does this say about my community? I'm not trying to, and they're saying explicitly, I'm not trying to aspire to whiteness. I'm trying to embrace my multiracial, multicultural background. But if I look at the larger Latinx community, there is this, and it's partly the way that the U.S. has constructed what Latinx, Latino means, what it's supposed to look like. And in that context, Latino is closer to white in many instances, and certainly does not include Blackness. And so I think that's, so part of that, those pre-existing tensions, both out of the country, and then bring those to the paradigms that we have here in the U.S., really do continue to create the tensions, but also I think that there's a lot of work being done by community organizers and scholars trying to figure out ways to say that there can be multiple perspectives within the same community. That doesn't have to be all or nothing or one way to look at it, but there are multiple, again, there are multiple names, categories that we use, labels that we use. And so there should be multiple perspectives looking at these communities as well.
Ed, I'm wondering how that insight that Michelle's offering us there also ties in with your book work, right? With this notion of being a new force in American politics, and yet also both this diversity of opinion and not just of opinion, but I mean, one of the ways that you can cast in your lot with the Black and brown and dispossessed people versus casting your lot in with folks who may be better resourced and are certainly much more likely to be white has to do with casting a ballot for the Democratic or Republican Party. And obviously, Latinx voters are much more heterogeneous in their voting than African Americans typically are. And I'm wondering, like, how that power in American politics also gets racialized.
Well, yeah, clearly our politics over the last 30 or 40 years has been, well, forever, you know, in the United States, strongly racialized. And in my book, I argue that Latin American descended people, and I'm using that phrase, you know, to avoid saying Latinx all the time, because I don't necessarily enforce it as, you know, something that I think people should use. I'm super interested by the term. But Latin American descended people in the U.S. really, I think, have more of a chance of, you know, gaining political power as a cohesive interest group by identifying with racial difference. When Latinx people abandon, you know, the notion of racial difference, they're just really sort of acting like most, like many white voters in the United States, and are now sort of becoming part of the larger constituency. I think that African-American voter blocs have a lot of power because they are unambiguous about identifying with the racial difference. And I think that you can see that African-Americans have consistently voted against Republicans by 80% to 90%, you know, over the last several election cycles. So I think that when Latinx people or people of Latin American descent abandon identification with racial difference, they abandon a chance at political power as a voting bloc.
Michelle, thoughts around the notion of voting as a bloc for power or reflecting these meaningful differences within community?
I mean, I think that's in part, I mean, obviously, as Ed pointed out, these are particularly useful and important, the way that we deploy them here in the U.S. But also we have to keep in mind that Latinx is not a racial monolith. So that's, I think that's why in some ways it can't, it's hard to pin it down necessarily as a block in some instances, or I think especially as we move into further into the 21st century. But I think we will continue. Right now we don't have many other kind of models for looking at them. And so looking at this population. And so I think that it will become even more, there will be more kind of complexity and trying to kind of gauge how this group is voting, because again it is different in different parts of the country, and I think in part, large part, because people are finding coalition and alliances with African American voting blocs, so I think that we're going to see some shifts in that in the coming elections.
I so appreciate from both of you the sense of standing just back enough, like both the attachment to, but also standing back just enough to have an interest, right? To watch it, to wonder about it, and to have a certain curiosity rather than solely a prescription. I think it's a helpful way for all of us to be trying to think about the development of language and identity and our self-namings, that we are both very attached to them, but also can be genuinely curious about the ways that the things that we call ourselves and how we understand our connections to others grows and changes over time. Michelle Reed Vasquez is an associate professor in the Department of Africana Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. And Ed Morales is a journalist and author of Latinx, The New Force in American Politics and Culture. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Carnegie Hall has welcomed a dizzying array of performers.
To have Andy Kaufman, Frank Zappa, and Birgit Nielsen and Horowitz on the same stage, it becomes this kaleidoscope of our history.
I'm Jessica Vosk. Join me for the new podcast, If This Hall Could Talk. It's all about our unique cultural history, as witnessed by one of New York's most beloved institutions, Carnegie Hall. Listen now, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Last week, U.S. wildlife officials recommended that 22 animals and one plant within the U.S. and Guam be marked extinct, gone forever. In total, the extinctions include 8 freshwater mussels, 11 birds, 2 fish, a bat, and a plant. And one of those now extinct birds is the ivory-billed woodpecker. Thanks to archive recordings from the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, we can still hear the sounds of that woodpecker. For more on this extinction crisis, we turn to Katrin Einhorn, who covers wildlife and extinction for the New York Times. Welcome to the show, Katrin.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is happening here? Why are species becoming extinct?
It's really because humans are changing the planet so drastically. right? I think that when we think of environmental crises, everyone's brain right now goes to climate change. And of course, that is a major environmental crisis. But there's another one, and that's a real crisis of biodiversity loss. Extinction rates are accelerating. So they're like 1,000 times above what they would naturally be, what would happen, you know, if species were just naturally occasionally going extinct. And that's because humans are basically taking away the habitat of animals. That's the major, major driving factor. It's not climate change yet, although it may become climate change down the road, right? And climate change is already adding to the problem. But the major thing is farming, logging, mining, overfishing at sea. And basically, we're just taking up so much room on this planet that animals don't have enough space left.
Okay, this might seem obvious, but I'm genuinely curious. How do I know if an animal or a plant is extinct? I have to say, my daughter's in second grade, and they're studying birds, and she's really into woodpeckers. Like, this is the bird that she's really chosen to obsess over at 7 years old. And when I learned that the ivory-billed woodpecker was one of the birds that had become extinct, I just, like, I felt it, like, in my stomach. But I also wondered, how would you know?
It's hard, right? Because you wouldn't necessarily know. You know, if we didn't have scientists studying these things, we wouldn't know. And one of the major concerns that scientists have is that species are blinking out that we haven't even registered. I mean, there are so many species that Western science hasn't even identified yet. And so, you know, do we even know what animals are going extinct? It's really leading scientists are very concerned about that. So with the ivory bill, this is a bird that was already quite rare by the turn of the century, by say, you know, the 1930s. And that's because European colonists and their descendants logged the areas where the ivory bills lived. And so as those areas were logged, the birds became fewer and fewer. And then there's this heartbreaking story that happened where in like the 1930s, 1940s, some ivory bills were found in Louisiana in this tract of land they called the Singer Tract, I believe because it may have been owned by like the Singer Sewing Machine Company. Mm-hmm. But then it somehow was transferred to like the Chicago Lumber and Mill Company. I'm not sure if I'm getting the name exactly right. But conservationists begged that lumber company not to log this land because they had found these ivory bills there, and they went ahead and did it. And that was before the Endangered Species Act. So now there is a law on the books which protects the habitat of threatened and endangered animals. But that protection wasn't in place for the ivory bill. And although some birders are convinced and still deeply believe that they have seen ivory bills in Arkansas very recently, federal officials just think that, you know, the best available science shows that they're extinct.
This is the sound of a Bachman warbler. It's another bird that U.S. wildlife officials say should be marked as extinct. And though there are protections for endangered species, Katrin told me there's been an acceleration of the loss of species.
Well, first of all, this is a global acceleration, right? And the Endangered Species Act is a more stringent law than most countries have on the books. But even within the United States, there's a lot of concern that while the Endangered Species Act can provide life support for animals and has had some incredible success stories in bringing animals back, like the black-footed ferret or the California condor, nevertheless, there are so many species that are suffering. For example, recently, federal officials announced that monarch butterflies are threatened and should be on the endangered species list, but they're basically kind of like on the waiting list because there's not enough resources to get them on the list.
Monarch butterflies?
Yeah, their populations are really plummeting. Yeah, especially the Western ones. Those are in terrible shape. I mean, that's like a 99% decline. I mean, that's really bad. But most monarchs, the Eastern monarchs, are the ones that overwinter in Mexico, you know, and they do this just incredible multi-generational migration between, you know, Northern United States and Canada all the way down to Mexico and back. And those butterflies are also showing really steep declines. And that's a combination of habitat change. So partly it's that, you know, milkweed is the only food that monarch caterpillars can eat. And milkweed grows naturally all over North America. But when farmers started using Roundup So the corn and the soy is genetically modified to resist the Roundup. It can resist the spraying, but obviously the milkweed is not. And so where it used to grow alongside those crops, it eliminated huge swaths of habitat. And so now people are planting milkweed to try and provide food, you know, in their, on their balconies, in their backyards, wherever it may be. And that's been a huge movement and it's great. But, you know, what scientists say is like, you're taking two steps forward and one step back, because then you also have the problem of climate change. So there are increased storms and drought that they're very vulnerable to.
So look, nothing would make me happier than just ranting maybe for the next 7 to 10 minutes about Roundup and about, you know, the effects. But I want to just like come to this. Farmers use what they have to use in order to grow crops to feed people and to try to turn at least some kind of profit or to look to break even. That's kind of, you know, farm life. No one's getting rich off of that. How do we balance something like the need for the monarch to have this milkweed to move across generations in this migration, and also to feed humans on the planet and for people to live above a level of subsistence?
This is the big question. And, you know, monarchs are one example, but like this is the problem of the biodiversity crisis in a much bigger way. And what these leading international panels of scientists who study this would say is we really need to change the way that we do agriculture, both in terms of moving more to regenerative agriculture, but also changing the way that we eat. Like we can't eat as intensively as we do in terms of the amount of meat that we eat ends up taking up such a big footprint. And it's not allowing enough space for the rest of the species on this planet, which, you know, our survival ultimately does depend on them or is interlinked with them. You know, we're talking about sort of this almost like a competition between agriculture and wild areas, but ultimately we rely on nature for our very survival. In other words, wetlands filter and restore groundwater. Pollinators pollinate our food. If we start seeing ecosystem collapse, it's going to affect us. So there are very selfish reasons that humans should be concerned about the biodiversity crisis.
Can you say a little more about the specifics of how that works? So I can hear right now the conversation that happens when I say a plant became extinct. I mean, I can see this sort of, you know, blank-eyed, so why do I care if a plant became extinct? Why do I care if Bachman's warbler is extinct? What difference does that make to me?
Right. And, you know, at the individual species level, I think that there's so much that researchers still don't know about this really intricate dance that ecosystems do. And so, you know, Bachman's warbler has been gone for some time, it seems. The ecosystem is not collapsing. So I don't know that there is a practical argument for that particular species. Of course, when you talk about too many species disappearing from an ecosystem, that's when you start really setting yourself up for some bigger problems. But apart from sort of the practical human-centered argument, I think that there are also moral arguments about our place on this earth. And, you know, it's interesting because people have such, now that I cover this, you know, people have such different reactions because some people just like you express such dismay at the thought of, oh my God, we drove this species to extinction. This is this, you know, result of untold years of evolution. And they have all these fascinating behaviors and characteristics that are now gone. And other people are like, so what? You know, I told someone, I was talking about cheetahs and how cheetahs are just really doing terribly. Their numbers are plummeting. And they were like, who cares if cheetahs go extinct? And I thought, huh, like, well, they're the fastest land mammal. I mean, they're so iconic in some way. And I don't really know how to respond to that other than, I don't know, like, do you care about art? Do you care about, it gets to sort of, at some point, I'm not totally sure how to communicate the importance of a cheetah to someone who doesn't think that cheetahs are worth anything or valuable to save.
Katrin Einhorn covers wildlife and extinction for the New York Times, and she gives her child a fabulous name. Katrin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
Fasten your seatbelts and get ready for a potentially very bumpy ride. The Supreme Court is due to hear some important cases over the next few months, with rulings that impact just really everybody. From reproductive rights to gun control, our conservative-leaning court may test the boundaries of our democracy. Here to discuss some of the cases this term and what's at stake is Ian Millhiser, a senior correspondent at Vox, where he focuses on the Supreme Court, the Constitution, and the decline of liberal democracy in the U.S. Welcome, Ian.
It's good to be here. Thanks so much.
All right. So what are some of the big cases up for the Supreme Court this term?
Well, I mean, the biggest case that I think everyone's going to be talking about is the Dobbs case. This is an existential threat to Roe v. Wade. The specific law at issue here is a Mississippi law which bans abortions after the 15th week of pregnancy. And the reason why that time frame is significant is that the rule right now is that if you are pregnant, you have an absolute right to terminate your pregnancy up to the point of viability, when the fetus could live outside of the womb. Viability occurs around the 22nd to the 24th week. So this is just a blatantly unconstitutional law. And the state of Mississippi has responded to that fact by just telling the Supreme Court, oh, yeah, you should just overrule Roe v. Wade and take away abortion rights altogether. So I think that there's a very high likelihood, given the 6-3 Republican majority on the Supreme Court, that this is going to end in maybe the explicit demise of Roe v. Wade, maybe a more roundabout way of ending abortion rights. But it's not going to be good news for people who need abortions.
So, Ian, you just said there the 6-3 Republican sort of, you know, balance of the court. But the justices are not themselves partisan. It's not like they ran for office here. Yes, they were appointed. But are they ever acting in ways as surprising as the dog in the background, like doing something that we don't expect?
Yeah, no, my dog Watson has very strong feelings about the partisanship of the Supreme Court. I mean, here's the thing, like, Mitch McConnell, you know, Senate Republicans didn't block Merrick Garland's nomination and confirm Neil Gorsuch for no reason at all. You know, they didn't race through to get Amy Coney Barrett into her seat while Donald Trump was still president for no reason at all. I mean, like, they understand that there are tremendous policy implications to whether the justices were nominated by Democratic or Republican presidents. You know, and what I think has changed a lot in the last several years, well, two things that have changed. One is that both parties, I think, just have a much more coherent sense of what they want from the court than they did, you know, 10 or 20 years ago. But the other thing that's changed is, you know, for most of American history, the court has always been political, but it wasn't particularly partisan. You normally find Democratic and Republican appointees on both sides of the major cases. That changed in 2010 when Justice Stevens, who was a liberal Ford appointee, was replaced by Elena Kagan, who is an Obama appointee. And that was the first time you had a coherent block of Republican appointees who tended to vote together and a coherent block of Democratic appointees that tended to vote together. That's a very new phenomenon in American history, but it's a real phenomenon. And I mean, I think it's something we have to confront when we talk about the Supreme Court.
All right. I want you to talk to us about a case that may not be as headline grabbing or sexy, but is absolutely critical. Can you talk about the American Hospital Association versus Becerra?
Sure. So this involves, I mean, there's no short way to summarize it. It involves a fundamental question, though, of how our government is structured. So there are a slew of laws where Congress will lay out a broad policy and then delegate to a federal agency the power to implement some of the details of that policy, to update aspects of that policy as things change. So an example of this is the Clean Air Act says that that certain power plants have to install what is called the best available technology that is cost effective to reduce emissions. And the best available technology is going to change over time. New technology is invented. And so it's the job of the EPA to monitor the technology that's out there and to issue new regulations saying, oh, they just invented this new thing that can reduce emissions even more. Now all you power plants have to install it. Conservatives, like the Conservative Federalist Society, is really all in on this, just don't like the fact that agencies have this kind of power. And the Becerra case is an attempt to limit the ability of agencies to make these decisions. There are a number of briefs that have been filed arguing that a very important case called Chevron, which says that when it is unclear whether an agency has power to act, court should typically defer to the agencies, whether that should be overruled. And I think this is going to be a major step along a longer road where the court is likely to dismantle much of Congress's power to empower agencies in this way.
Yeah, Chevron rule, that's like one of those things I learned when I married a lawyer, for sure. Now, final thing I want to ask you about here is about guns. What are we looking at in terms of cases that might make some decisions around that?
Yeah, so there's a big case, New York State Rifle and Pistol Association v. Bruin. This challenges a New York State law that is over 100 years old, saying that in order to get a license to carry a handgun in public, you have to demonstrate proper cause to obtain the license. So you can't just say, I want to carry a gun. There has to be some reason why, like, you're fearful and you think you need one. And the significant thing about this case, the seminal Supreme Court case defining the scope of the Second Amendment, is a case called DC v. Heller from 2008. And Heller has a ton of language limiting the scope of the Second Amendment. You know, bans on concealed weapons are still okay. Bans on possessions of guns by people with felony convictions or serious mental illnesses are still okay. You can still ban guns in sensitive places. You can ban what are called dangerous and unusual weapons. Whole lot of limits on the Second Amendment. That language in the Heller decision was inserted at the insistence of Justice Kennedy, who was a more moderate conservative than the conservatives that are on the court right now. And now that Kennedy is gone, he was replaced by the much more conservative Brett Kavanaugh. Now that Justice Barrett is there, I think it's very likely that the court is going to expand the Second Amendment and possibly dismantle, you know, much of that language from the Heller decision.
Ian Millhiser is senior correspondent at Vox. Thank you and your pup for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, hope you enjoyed the show. And thanks as always for tuning in. Before we go, we wanted to send out strength and love to the families, teachers, students, and community of Timberview High School in Arlington, Texas. Multiple people were injured yesterday in a shooting at the school, and we know so many more walked away from the day with wounded hearts and spirits. Here at The Takeaway, we just want to acknowledge the pain and frustration so many communities are feeling as our young people cope with this kind of violence. Now, if you missed anything or you want to listen back again, check out our podcast. It's available wherever you get your podcasts, or you can catch us at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. We will be back tomorrow.